If they do this, there will be no need for violence of any kind. I admit, I kind of like these guys, Holden whispered to Naomi. I mean, as conquistadors go. There'll be a but, she said. There's always a but. Cooperation is the coin of the Empire, Trejo continued. The beginnings were already in motion here. Your association of worlds, the transport union, all of these things will continue. High Consul Duarte wants input and representation from all the systems humanity has colonized and will colonize. The transport union is a vital apparatus in supporting those efforts. Both organizations can and must continue their important work. The only thing that has changed is that High Consul Duarte will be expediting the process. The Laconian fleet will be the defenders of a new galactic civilization of which you will all be welcome citizens. The only price is cooperation with the new order, and a tax to be paid to the Empire that will not be onerous and will be entirely invested back into the creation of new infrastructure and aid to fledgling or struggling planetary economies. The golden age of man will begin under the High Consul's leadership. Trejo paused again, his smile slipping. He looked pained and saddened by what he was about to say. "Here it comes," Naomi whispered. "But to those who intend to defy this new government and try to deny humanity its bright future, I say this. You will be eradicated without hesitation or mercy. The military might of Laconia has only one function, and that is the defense and protection of the Empire and its citizens. Loyal citizens of the Empire will know only peace and prosperity, and the absolute certainty of their own safety under our watchful eye. Disloyalty has one outcome. Death." "Ah," Naomi said, though it was more a long exhalation than a word. "The nicest totalitarian government ever, I'm sure. By the time we figure out all the ways it isn't," Holden said, "it will be too late to do anything about it." "Will be?" Naomi asked. "Or is?" Chapter 13. Drummer. McCahill, head of the Security Council, spread his hands before him like he was trying to talk a gunman into putting down his weapon. "We were all taken by surprise, and I think we can all agree this was a failure of intelligence." "Well, if we all agree, then I guess it's not a problem," Drummer said. McCahill flinched a little. "What the hell happened out there?" The meeting room was small. McCahill, Santos Baca, and the present liaison of the Earth-Mars Coalition, Benedito Laughlin. And Vaughn haunting the back of the room like a funeral director at a wake. There were others in her feed. Messages from every division of the Union and dozens of organizations outside it, too. A kicked anthill, the size of the solar system, and all of them wanting answers and leadership from her. It would take days to view all of them, weeks to reply, and she didn't have the time or the energy. She needed answers. Answers and a way to turn time backward long enough to undo what had already happened. Laughlin was a thick-faced man with a tight haircut that made him look like a particularly self-satisfied toad. He cleared his throat. "Data on Laconia has always been thin," he said. He had a reedy voice, and the manner of a doctor explaining why he'd left a sponge in someone's belly by mistake. "The defecting forces from Mars have been playing their keep-away message since before the Transport Union was chartered. They've flooded the gate from the real space side with chatter along the whole electromagnetic spectrum. Radio, visible light, X-ray, everything. We've had no passive intelligence to speak of. The few times that probes were sent through, they were disabled or destroyed. The official doctrine put in during the first years of the Union was blockade. The navies of Earth and Mars were both badly damaged in the fight against the Free Navy. The focus of governance was disaster recovery on Earth and minimizing the collapse of infrastructure. Laconia never presented an active threat, and you're telling me the missing Navy was just never a priority? Drummer said. But she already knew the answer. Yes, that's what he was saying. Sleeping dogs had been left to lie until they were good and rested. And the sting of it was worse, because some of that, at least, had been during her watch. She was as guilty as anyone of taking her eye off the ball. The images that had come through from Medina were surreal. The ship that had sailed through from Laconia didn't resemble anything that had gone out through the gate decades ago. The blast that had scattered the Tory Byron was more like high-energy stellar phenomena than a weapon humanity had conceived, and the destruction of the railgun emplacements had been accompanied by a blast of gamma radiation from the gates themselves that Cameron Tour described as the energetic equivalent of a solar flare. It had destroyed the Sharon Chavez, a freighter that had been waiting for clearance from Medina's traffic control. Her crew died in the blink of an eye, and not even from a direct attack. It wasn't something Drummer could get her mind to accept. It was too big, too strange, too sudden. "The attacker has disabled the relay network," Vaughn said, answering something Santos Baca had asked. "There are no new signals coming in or out of the ring space. Medina is effectively cut off." Drummer squeezed her fists until they ached. She couldn't let her mind wander like that. It didn't matter that she felt traumatized. The Union was under attack, and it was all on her. She had to keep focus. "We do have some record from the freighter that was parked outside the gate. The interference is too severe to get anything with high definition, but enough that we can say with some confidence that Medina Station was boarded. We have to assume it's been taken." "Can we get data through the gates?" Drummer asked. "Radio loud enough to carry through the interference on both sides? Or tight beams? Something to get messages to the other systems?" "It's possible," Laughlin said in a tone of voice that meant he didn't actually think it was possible. "But it would certainly be monitored. And our encryption schema aren't breakable by any known tech, but we're not looking at known tech." His hand terminal chimed. He glanced at the message and lifted his eyebrow. "Excuse me for a moment. Someone's made a mistake." Drummer waved her permission, and the inner left them to themselves. When the doors had closed behind him, she turned to Santos Baca and McCahill. "Well, seeing as it's just us, what are the options?" "If we can find a way to communicate with the other systems, we can coordinate a counterattack," Santos Baca said. "I've been putting together a spreadsheet of the resources we have in each system." "Let me see," Drummer said. Santos Baca flipped the data to Drummer's display. "More than 1,300 gates, each opening onto a new solar system. Almost all of them with colonies that varied from barely functioning villages to scientific complexes that were on the ragged edge of self-sustainability. The Union's void cities were the largest ships, but you could only pour attacking forces through so quickly without losing them to the gate's glitches. She'd be sending them through one at a time to be mowed down." She pressed her fingers to her lips, pinching the flesh against her teeth until it ached a little. There was a way. There had to be a way. She had to put first things first. And that meant re-establishing communications with all the Union forces in all the systems. Some kind of stealth relay system had to be put in place. Maybe some kind of feint that would draw the enemy's attention long enough to let her sneak new repeaters on either side of, if not all the gates, then a strategic few. "Ma'am," Laughlin said from behind her, "please, you can't..." An unfamiliar voice answered, "Give it a fucking rest, Benedito. I can do whatever the fuck I want. Who's going to tell me not to? You?" The old woman moved slowly, using a cane even in the light gravity of People's Home. Her hair was blindingly white, thinning, and pulled back in a bun at the base of her skull. Her skin was slack and papery, but there was an intelligence in her eyes that the years hadn't dimmed. She looked up at Drummer and smiled with the warmth of a grandmother. "Carmina, it's good to see you. I got the first shuttle I could. How's your brother doing?" Drummer pushed through a flurry of reactions, surprise that the woman was here, a flicker of starstruck awe, disorientation at being called by her first name in public, distrust that Christian Avasarala, the retired grand dame of inner planet politics, knew about her brother at all, and finally the solid certainty that every feeling she just experienced had been anticipated, more than anticipated, designed. It was all a manipulation, but done so well and with such grace that knowing that didn't make it ineffective. "He's fine," Drummer said. "The regrowth went well."
"Good, good,"
Avasarala said, lowering herself into a chair.
"Astounding what they can do with neural replacement these days. When I was growing up, they cocked it up more than they got it right. I had most of my peripheral nervous system redone a couple years ago. Works better than the old stuff, except my leg gets restless at night."
Santos Baca and McCahill both smiled, but with anxiety in their eyes.
"Ma'am," Laughlin said, "please, we're in the middle of a meeting."
"You can finish it later," Avasarala said. "President Drummer and I need to talk."
"I didn't see you on my schedule," Drummer said mildly.
Avasarala turned back to her. The warmth was gone, but the intellect was there, sharp and feral.
"I've been where you are right now," the old woman said. "I'm the only one in the whole human race who has. The way your stomach feels when you try to eat, the part of you that's screaming all the time, even when you're acting calm, the guilt. Anyone who's had a child in the hospital has suffered through that shit. But the part where all human history rides on what you do, and you only get one shot, that's only you and me. I came because you need me here.
I appreciate you're about to fuck up," Avasarala said, and her voice was harder than stone.
"I can keep that from happening.
And we can have that conversation here in front of these poor fucking shitheads, or you can roll your eyes and humor the crazy old bitch with a cup of tea, and we can have a little privacy. You can blame me for it. I won't mind. I'm too old and tired for shame."
Drummer laced her fingers together. Her jaw ached, and she had to focus to unclench it. She wanted to scream. She wanted to have Avasarala thrown out of the city in a plastic emergency bubble with a note tacked to her cane that said, "Make an appointment first." She wanted to see McCahill and Santos Baca look at her with awe and fear at the violence of her reaction. And none of those things had anything to do with Christian Avasarala. They were all of them about what had happened to Medina.
"Vaughn," Drummer said, "could you get Madame Avasarala a pot of tea?"
We'll take a recess of an hour or so.
Of course, Madam President, Vaughn said. The others rose from their chairs. Santos Baca took a moment to shake Avasarala's hand before she left.
Drummer scratched her chin, even though it didn't itch, and kept her temper until the room was empty except for the two of them. When she spoke, it was with a careful, measured tone.
If you ever undermine me like that again, I will find a way to make everyone in the EMC stop taking your calls. I will isolate you like no one this side of a prison door has ever been isolated. You'll spend the last days of your life trying to talk interns into getting you coffee.
It was a dick move, Avasarala said, pouring a cup of tea for herself and then another one for Drummer. It's my fault. I overreact when I'm scared.
She hobbled across the room and set the mug down in front of Drummer. An act of submission as calculated as everything she'd done. Whether it was sincere or insincere didn't matter. She'd kept the form. Drummer picked up the tea, blew across it, and sipped. Because keeping the form was all that was keeping her together now, too.
Avasarala nodded her approval and went back to her seat.
I'm scared, too, Drummer said.
I know. That was some frightening shit that came back from Medina.
That ship? I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen speculation about anything like it.
Avasarala picked up her own mug, sipped, and nodded toward the tea.
This is good.
We grow it here. Real leaves. All the food chemists in the system will never do better than evolution at making a decent tea leaf.
How am I about to fuck up?
By trying to get back your losses, Avasarala said. It's not just you, either. You're going to have advisors on all sides who want the same damn thing. Mass a force to reclaim Medina, find a way to coordinate, take the fight back to Laconia. Through a massive effort and at tremendous cost, push our way back to the status quo ante.
Sunk cost fallacy?
Yes.
So you don't think... Drummer had to stop. The words were physically gagging her.
She swallowed more tea, the heat of it loosening her throat.
You don't think we can get the slow zone back?
How the fuck would I know? But I do know you can't get it back as your first step. And I know how much you want to. It feels like if you're just smart enough, fast enough, strong enough now, it won't have happened the way it already did. But that's not how it's going to work. And I know how consuming that grief can be. Grief makes people crazy. It did me.
It was like the air mix in the room was wrong. Nothing Avasarala was saying was news to her, but the sympathy in the old woman's voice was worse than shouting. A vast fear, wide and cruel, welled up in Drummer's gut. She put her mug back down with a click, and Avasarala nodded.
I was briefed about Duarte back in the day, the old woman said. Mars didn't want to share anything back then. I thought at the time it was because they'd just been surprise ass-fucked by one of their own, and it was shame. That was true, as far as it went. But after I retired, I made him a hobby of mine.
A hobby?
I'm shitty at quilting. I had to do something, she said, waving a hand. Then a moment later, I found his thesis. The little book she held out was printed on thin paper with a pale green cover. It was rough against her fingertips. The title was in a simple font with no adornment. Logistics-Based Strategy in Interplanetary Conflict by Winston Duarte.
He wrote it at university, Avasarala said. He tried to have it published, but it never went anywhere. It was enough to get him a position in the Martian Navy. Put him on a career path.
All right, Drummer said, thumbing through the pages.
After the Free Navy, the best intelligence services in two worlds went over that man's life in so much detail you could get the Christian names of every flea that bit him. I've read, 50 analyses? Maybe more than that. It all comes back to those 130 pages there.
Why?
Because that's a plan for Mars to take control of the solar system away from Earth and the belt without firing a shot. And it would have worked.
Drummer frowned, opened the book to a random page. The control of resources can be achieved through three strategies: occupation, influence, and economic necessity. Of these, occupation is the least stable. A chart on the facing page listed minerals and their locations in the belt. Avasala was watching her, dark eyes fixed and penetrating. When she spoke, her voice was soft.
At 20 years old, Winston Duarte saw the path that none of his superiors did, and that no one on Earth did. He laid it all out, point by point, and the only reason history ran the way it did is that no one took much notice. Then he was a good, solid career officer for decades until he saw something, an opportunity maybe, in the data from the first wave of probes that went through the gates. Without changing the time of day when he got his hair cut, he shifted into engineering the biggest theft in the history of warfare. He took the only active protomolecule sample, enough ships to defend a gate, and engineered the chaos that knocked Earth and Mars on their asses.
I know all that, Drummer said.
You do, Avasala said, and you know what that means. But you're scared, and you're traumatized, and you don't want to look it in the face because your husband is on Medina Station.
Drummer picked up her tea and sipped without tasting it. Her stomach felt tight. Her throat was thick.
Avasala waited, letting the silence stretch between them. Saba was on Medina Station. It was a thought she'd been avoiding, and it was like touching a wound.
Duarte's good, Drummer said at last. He's very good at what he does.
And he came back in his own time and on his own terms.
Yes, Avasala agreed.
You're telling me he won't overreach.
I'm telling you he came back because he thinks he can win, Avasala said.
And if he thinks that, you should prepare yourself for the idea that it's true.
There's no point then, Drummer said. We should just roll over. Put our necks under his boot and hope he doesn't step on us too hard?
Of course not. But don't talk yourself into underestimating him because you want him to be the next Marco Inaros. Duarte won't hand you a win by being a dumb fuck. He won't spread himself too thin. He won't overreach. He won't make up 6 plans and then spin a bottle to pick one. He's a chess player. And if you act on instinct, do the thing your feelings demand, he'll beat us all.
Give up Medina and the slow zone and all the colony worlds.
Recognize that they're occupied territory, Avasala said. Protect what you can protect. Sol system. Reach out where you can, if you can. There are still people loyal to the Union on Medina. And Duarte's intelligence in the last few decades is going to be thin, at least at first. Find angles he doesn't know. But don't take him on straight.
Drummer felt a little click in her heart, the physical sensation of comprehension. Avasarala was making the case for defending Earth. That was why she'd come to her. Drummer and the Union, the Void Cities, and the gunships were critical to keeping Earth and Mars safe. The strategy she was arguing for was all about playing defense, and the thing Drummer would be defending was, in the final analysis, the inner planets. That's what she and her people would be asked to die for. Earth and Mars and all the people who'd made their civilizations on the back of the Belters back in the days before the Union. It wasn't just strategy. It was naked self-interest. Also, it was right. Medina was behind enemy lines now, and Drummer wasn't going to be able to take it back. That didn't mean she was powerless. So, she said, what do we have to work with? The Coalition fleet, Avasarala said, the Union fleet, and whatever agents we can coordinate with on Medina. We can't reach anyone on Medina, Drummer said. The communications channels are all under Duarte's control. Avasarala sighed and looked at her hands. Yours are, she said. It took a moment for Drummer to understand. Avasarala shrugged. Everyone spies on everyone, Kamina. Let's not pretend to be outraged at water for being wet. You have a way to get messages to Medina? I didn't say that, Avasarala said. But I know a lot of people. Chapter 14. Sing. There have been significant changes to the internal structure of the station, Colonel Tanaka said. Not that surprising. This was all supposed to be a generation ship that spun at a full G for a few centuries. Now it's a way station at a third. A lot of the infrastructure would want rethinking, and there's never been a Belter ship that didn't get modified to suit the moment. If they hadn't purged their security and maintenance databases, we'd know a great deal more. But there's nothing lost here that we can't build back, given time. I see, Singh said, considering the possible methods of recapturing the lost data. In addition, we've recovered 1,264 firearms in our sweeps, the vast majority of which were handguns, she said, scrolling through the list on her monitor. Areas with complex compounds that can easily be used in bomb-making are under strict security watches. But we'll need to make some extensive redistribution and security changes before everything can be effectively locked down. Anything else? Singh asked. They still have kitchen knives and power tools, and anything we missed. Tanaka was out of her power armor, and her long, lean form was insolently stretched out across a chair in Singh's office. She was older than him by almost 2 decades, and he could see her reaction to his relative youth in the way she held her shoulders and the shape of her smile. She play-acted respect for him. The office, his office, was small enough to be functional. A desk, chairs, a small decorative counter with its own bar. The workspace of an important administrator. He'd taken over a complex that had once been accounting space, based on the names and titles they hadn't scraped off the doors yet. The ops and command decks, like engineering and the docks, were in the part of the station that was permanently on the float, and he found the idea of working in Null G uncomfortable. And more than that, he'd seen from Duarte and from Trejo what a real commander's space looked like, and it looked humble. He went back to the issue that bothered him most. 1,200 guns? There were less than 100 security personnel on the whole station. Belters have a long tradition of not trusting governmental authorities to protect them, Tanaka replied with a shrug. Nearly all of these weapons were in civilian hands. But the Belters are the government here. They're belters, she said, as if her experiences before Laconia explained everything that was happening now. They resist centralized authority. It's what they do. She gave the report one last glance, then slapped the monitor against her arm where it curled up into a thick bracelet. I have meetings today with their centralized authority, so that should be illuminating, Singh said, surprised at the contempt in his voice. Tanaka gave him a little half-smile. How old were you during the Io campaign? She asked. It felt like a bit of a dig. He remembered the Io campaign the way most children in his generation did. The news feeds announcing the launches toward Mars. The gut-clenching fear that one of the missiles bearing the alien hybrids would make it as far as the Martian surface. Even after the crisis had passed, the weeks of nightmares. He'd been a child then, and the memory had the near mythical feel of a story retold until it barely resembled its truth. Those terrible days that had convinced his parents that something more would have to be done to protect humanity from itself and its new discoveries, it had planted the seeds that bloomed under the skies of Laconia. But bringing up his age now felt like a power play, a way to point out how little experience he had. He tried not to show that it got under his skin. Not old enough to think of it as the Io campaign, though of course I'm thoroughly versed on the history. I was a JG when that shitstorm went down, Tanaka said. We were actively fighting with Belter factions back then. You probably think these people are a half step up from spear-carrying savages. I don't. And you'd be right, she continued. They can be the most stupidly stubborn people you'll ever meet. But they're tough as nails, and resourceful. I think you misunderstood me, Singh said, fighting to keep a flush out of his cheeks. I'm sure, Tanaka said, then stood up. I have an interview with the technical assessment crew. I'll report in when I'm done with them. In the meantime, don't leave this office without your monitor on. Security directive. Of course, Singh said. The flush of shame he'd felt, shifting over into anger. Personnel security fell under Tanaka's operational command while they were occupying the station. It was one of the few areas where Singh could not countermand her orders, so after dressing him down and questioning his understanding of their situation, she was now delivering a direct order. The humiliation stung. Appreciated, she said, and headed for the door. Colonel, Singh said at her back. He waited until she'd turned to look back at him. I am the provisional governor of this station, by direct order from High Consul Duarte himself. When you're in this office, you will stand at attention until I offer you a seat, and you will salute me as your superior. Is that understood? Tanaka cocked her head to the side and gave him another of her enigmatic little half-smiles. It occurred to Singh that Aliana Tanaka had risen to the rank of colonel in the most punishingly trained combat unit humanity had ever known, and that he was alone in his office with her. He wanted to look down at her legs, see if she was rolling up onto the balls of her feet or shifting her stance. Instead, he stared her in the eye and clamped his stomach down into a knot. If he was supposed to be kind and humble, to ask about her family and trade familiarities with her, he was doing a poor job of it. Sir, Tanaka said, coming to attention with a sharp salute. Yes, sir. Dismissed, Singh said, then sat down and looked at his monitor as though she'd already disappeared. A moment later, his door opened and then closed. Only then did he collapse back into his chair and wipe the sweat off his face. Give me one reason we don't tell you to go fuck yourselves, the head of Medina Station's Air, Water, and Power Authority said. The AWP, The AWP works for us now, Singh replied, keeping his voice level. Like hell we do. It's shock, Singh told himself. It's surprise and confusion and sorrow that the universe doesn't behave the way they thought it did. And everyone on Medina Station, maybe everyone on the colonies and in Sol System 2, was going to be struggling with it. All he could do for them was keep telling the truth as clearly and as simply as he could and hope it sank in. You do, Singh continued. And if you do not order your workers to resume their duties, I will have technicians from the Gathering Storm take over for them, and then I will have every single member of your organization arrested. You can't do that, the AWP chief said with bravado, but he rubbed his bald head and his expression wasn't as certain. I can, Singh said. Everyone on your staff is back at work by next shift rotation or I start issuing arrest orders. You won't. Dismissed, Singh said, then gestured at one of his marine guards who ushered the AWP chief out of the room. Putting Medina Station in order was messy. He had imagined, coming out, that as governor of the station he would be kept apart from the normal rank-and-file citizens and laborers, that he would have a status that kept those around him a little more in awe, with underlings to deal directly with the hands-on administration. In practice, Admiral Trejo had the role of power, and he was the underling. He accepted it with good grace. It would all be more pleasant in a few months, when the new defense emplacements were complete and the Tempest could progress to the next phase of their mission. The briefings he'd had on the way out, all information gleaned from passively monitoring the backsplash radio that leaked through Laconia's ring gate, were accurate, but wildly incomplete. It left him feeling a half-step behind himself all the time. It wasn't even the basic structures. Those were constrained by the biological and energetic needs of the ships and station, and so were, in a sense, predictable. It was the cultural forms and expectations. The absurdities and accidents of human character that affected the flow of goods and information in ways that were as unpredictable as they were exhausting. Like having to throw an entire branch of Medina's infrastructure staff in the brig. Who's next? Singh asked his aide, a junior lieutenant named Kasich he'd grabbed from the admin pool on the Storm. Kasich scrolled through a list on his monitor. You have Carrie Fisk next, Kasich said. The president of the Association of Worlds, Singh said with a laugh. Bring her in. Carrie Fisk entered his office, her frown lines and fidgety hands telling Singh she'd be trying to hide her fear with anger. She was a short, thin woman, with a severe face and beautiful black hair piled up on her head. Her clothes were expensive. Someone from one of the richer colonies, then. He knew her from the news feeds they'd captured. She looked thinner and less pleasant in person. Singh gestured at the chair across from his desk and said, "Please sit, Madam President." She sat, the anger dissipating at his politeness. "Thank you." "Madam President, I have news," Singh said, flicking a document from his monitor at her. The hand terminal in her pocket chimed. "And it will be good news or bad news, depending on how seriously you take your job and how much you like doing actual work. You may read that later to get all the details." She'd started to take the terminal out of her pocket, but slid it back at his words. "I take my job very seriously." "Excellent, because it seems you used to have a title that held no actual power, except that you presided over the Association of Worlds and their meetings here, which is a body that negotiates interplanetary laws it has absolutely no ability to enforce. Earth and Mars haven't formally joined your coalition, and the Transport Union has been in a position to dictate terms in all your agreements, or so I'm led to understand. My access to the news feeds has been limited." He tried for a self-deprecating smile, and thought he probably got about 3/4 of the way there.
"It's a start," Fisk said, the frown returning to her face.
"At least we have people here talking out their problems rather than immediately reaching for a gun."
"I agree,"
Singh said. "And more importantly, so does High Consul Duarte.
The document I just sent you empowers the Association of Worlds to make laws that will have binding authority on the member systems, which now includes every human colony.
You, as president of that body, will be granted a variety of legislative powers to aid in that cause.
And who is granting us this new power?" Fisk asked.
Her face had twisted up, like he'd asked her to eat something distasteful. She knew the answer to his question, but she wanted him to say it so that she could begin her counter-argument. A counter-argument Singh had no interest in entertaining.
"High Consul Winston Duarte, who is now the supreme executive authority of the Association of Worlds and all subsidiary governments. All edicts passed by this body that are not vetoed by the executive power will have the force of law, backed by the military power of Laconia."
"I don't know if..."
"Madam President," Singh said, leaning forward and waiting until her attention was fully on him before he continued, "I advise you to take this very seriously. The High Council wants a fully functioning legislature and bureaucracy, and believes that the existing one, with some modification of course, fits the bill. I strongly advise that you not give him a reason to think it's better to tear this down and build something new in its place. Do we understand each other?"
Fisk nodded. Her hands were fidgeting in her lap again.
"Excellent," Singh said. He stood up and extended his hand. Fisk stood and took it. "I look forward to working with you as High Consul Duarte's representative. We have much to do, but I believe it will be exciting and rewarding work."
Singh released her hand and gave a small bow.
"What comes next?"
Fisk asked.
"I would recommend you begin by familiarizing yourself with the document I sent you. It contains all the provisional rules for the Association legislature until such time as more permanent protocols can be voted into place."
"Okay," Fisk said.
"I know you will be quite busy," Singh told her, gently guiding her past his marine guards and over to the door. "But I look forward to our next meeting."
Once she'd left, he let out a long sigh and leaned against the wall.
"One more, Lieutenant, then we can break for lunch," he said.
"Yes, sir," Kasich said. "Next is Anni Langstiever, head of station security for Medina."
Singh smiled a little, thinking how Tanaka would have reacted to hearing that title.
"Former head of security," he said as he returned to his desk.
"Give me a moment. Let him wait."
"Yes, sir," Kasich said.
"Can I get you anything in the meantime? Water? Coffee?"
"The water here tastes like old piss, and the coffee tastes like old piss run through a gym sock," Singh said. "The recycling systems on this station are decades out of date and badly maintained."
"Yes, sir," Kasich replied.
"I can have water brought from the storm for you."
"Or," Singh said, turning to his aide,
"we can go about actually fixing the problems here."
"Yes, sir," Kasich said, bobbing his head.
If Singh hadn't been tired already and irritable, he would have let it sit there. But the constant pushing back from his own people and the natives of Medina had scratched him enough to raise welts, and he couldn't quite rein himself in.
"If the posting here becomes permanent," he said, "and there is no reason to think it won't, I will be bringing my family to this station. I won't have my daughter drinking badly recycled water, breathing badly filtered air, and attending badly run schools."
Kasich had found a bottle of water from somewhere and was pouring it into the coffee machine.
"Yes, sir," he said, like it had become an autonomic reaction.
"Lieutenant, look at me."
"Sir?"
Kasich said, turning around. What we're doing here is important. Not just for Laconia, but for all of humanity. These people, they need us. They even need us to show them that they need us. When you have children, you'll understand why that matters. Until then, you will behave at all times as an example of Laconian character and discipline. If you don't understand why that's critical, you will act as though you understand, or I will place you in charge of personally scrubbing the water recycling system until it produces laboratory-grade potables. Are we clear? If there was a flicker of resentment in the man's eyes, it was a natural reaction to discipline. Crystal, Governor Singh. Excellent. Then send their former head of security in. Ani Lungstever was a lanky belter type in a sloppy Medina security uniform, with greasy hair and a permanent sneer curling his lip. He looked over Singh's marine guards just inside the door, then gave Singh himself a look of such low cunning that he almost had the man turned back out again. "I'm here," Ani said. "You want, boss man?" "We're going to discuss your change in status on this station," Singh said. "Discuss? Bis bien. Let's discuss." Ani shrugged, then walked toward the guest chair. "Do not sit," Singh said. Something in his tone brought Ani up short, and the man frowned at him as if really seeing him for the first time. "You won't be here long." Ani shrugged again, a short lift of both hands that did not involve the shoulders. The PsyOps briefing on Belter culture had talked about this, that most of their physical gestures had evolved to use the hands only because they spent so much time in vacuum suits that body language was invisible. It also talked about their cultural conviction that they were the put-upon victims in all interactions with non-Belters. Well, if this Ani had come into the room expecting to be victimized, Singh would oblige him. "You are no longer the head of security on Medina Station," Singh said. "Who's the new boss?" Ani replied. He wasn't angry, which was interesting. "It doesn't matter to you," Singh said with a smile, "because you no longer work for station security. In fact, you no longer hold any official duties of any kind on this station. The last official task you will perform is to hand over all personal files related to this station that are not in the official database. Failure to do this will result in arrest and prosecution by a military tribunal of the Laconian Navy."
"Sure, sure, Jefelito. Only you know most that's gone. Purged," Ani said.
"What you have, you will surrender. You're the man now. You may leave." A smile passed over Ani's face, soft and ingratiating. Singh had seen this before, from the playground to the academy. He'd seen it as a boy in the eyes of the science team that had been on Laconia when Duarte's ships arrived, and on the football team when the woman who'd been their coach was reassigned and a new man stepped in. Respect for power, yes, but also the scent of opportunity. The opportunism of making good with the new powers.
"One thing, boss man," Ani said, as Singh had known he would.
"No, not one more."
"No, no, no, wait. You've got to hear this one."
"Fine," Singh said, "out with it." "So, that weapon your big ship used, the magnetic one?"
"The Tempest, yes, what about it?"
"Yeah, so," Ani said, then paused to scratch his greasy hair and smirk. "When you hit the hub station with it, where the rail guns were?"
"Yes," Singh said. "We have extensive experience with similar artifacts and judge the risk to be minimal."
"Okay, so when that beam thing hit the hub station, that pinche ball glowed bright yellow for, 15 seconds. Anytime anything hits the ball that dumps any energy into it, you get these little flashes of yellow. This is the first time the whole damn thing lit up. And 15 seconds is a long time.
I'm having trouble understanding your point, Singh said. So, during that 15 seconds, all 1,300 rings dumped a massive gamma-ray burst into their systems. Hard enough that four ships on approach to the rings had their crews cooked. Emergency systems kicked in. Autopilot stopped the ships so we don't have four unmanned projectiles flying through the rings at us, but Oni lifted his hands, as if he was presenting a gift. Singh blinked and sat back. Something shifted in his belly. An emotion he hadn't felt since he'd arrived at Medina. Surprise. Maybe even hope. The ring space was, by the best understanding of the science teams, one of the most energetically active things in the perceivable universe. The power required to keep the space itself from collapsing was astounding even to people who routinely built things like Magnetar-class battleships. The effect Longstiever described wouldn't even be a rounding error in the overall system, but the application of it could mean a significant windfall. How do you know this? The Belter spread his hands. I live here. I know things not everybody knows. Is this correct? Singh said, not to Oni, but to Kasich. I'll have a report prepared immediately, Kasich replied, and left the room already talking at his wrist. So yeah, Oni continued, laughing a little now, acting as if he'd already ingratiated himself. If he wasn't corrected, it would become true. Transport Union's gonna be pissed you just cooked four of their freighter crews. Singh considered the man. He would need local contacts. Natives of Medina Station who were loyal to the new power structure and supporters of Laconian rule. The prospect of having this bootlicker as one of the first among them was beneath his dignity. Dismissed, Singh said to the man. He needed to call Trejo on Tempest and report this. Oni's face fell. The smile faded first into surprise and then indignation and resentment. Rejection bloomed into hatred while Singh watched. He'd rarely made a decision proven right so definitively or so quickly. People of this low character would never be part of his administration, and it was telling that Oni had managed to gain power on Medina. Bosmang, you gotta listen to me, Oni said. I said you're dismissed, Singh barked at him, then looked to one of his marine guards. She immediately grabbed Oni by the arm, halfway lifting him off the ground with her armor's augmented strength. Ouch, fuck! Oni yelled as she dragged him out of the room. Have a cart brought around, Singh said to the remaining marine. I want to go to the ops center and look over the data about this gamma ray burst. Aye, sir, the marine said, then stepped out of the room. Singh needed to corroborate Oni's story first, then get a full report to Admiral Trejo. If the man was correct, then they had the ability to release a lethal gamma-ray burst through the gates whenever they wished. Could there be a more powerful means of controlling travel through the network? It had the potential to shave months off their timetable in establishing control over the various colony worlds. For the first time that day, Singh felt himself relax. He might have just won the Empire for Laconia. All without firing a shot in anger. Chapter 15. Bobby. As an operator in the Orbital Drop Task Force, Bobby had trained with Spec Ops personnel from every command in the Martian military for a single purpose: the invasion of Earth. And while the old axiom, "If you wish for peace, prepare for war," was not without its skeptics, that skepticism wasn't shared by the Martian military. The doctrine that drove Mars in the century and a half following its declaration of independence relied on it. Mars would never have as large a population or as big an industrial base as Earth. The only thing that prevented Earth from reconquering her wayward colony was a constant demonstration of Mars's willingness and ability to hit back hard. As long as they could land on Earth's streets, Earth would hesitate to fight in their tunnels. Bobby and her fellow Marines in Force Recon regularly and visibly trained for that day. They took drugs and worked out in full gravity until Earth would be merely uncomfortable, not bone-crushing. They practiced dropping from orbit in troop carriers and one-person pods. They trained in urban pacification and insurgent elimination. They learned to make up for what they lacked in troop numbers by using aggression and intimidation to keep the conquered people in line. She had literally spent years preparing to move through the streets of Earth, commanding obedience through the threat of death. The invasion and conquest of Medina Station was civilized by comparison. She wondered whether that would last. Four Laconian Marines in their power armor stood watch in the dock offices, mag boots locked to the deck, and kept a close eye on the line of people waiting to talk to the dockmaster. But while they appeared vigilant, they were not aggressive. They acted like their presence was sufficiently intimidating to keep the populace in line. With some sort of slug thrower built into the armor in each forearm, and a pair of what looked like grenade launchers on each shoulder, Bobby decided they were right. There were probably 30 people on the float waiting for the dockmaster. The four Laconians looked like they could have handled 10 times that number. She'd been like them, once. "I like your suit," she said to the Laconian closest to her. "Excuse me?" he said, not looking at her, continuing to scan the room. "I like your suit. I wore an old Goliath back in the day." That got his attention. The Laconian looked her over once, feet on up. He was so much like the team she'd trained with when she joined up, it felt like looking back through time. She wondered if he was as ignorant as she'd been back then. Probably. Hell, maybe more so. "MMC Force Recon?" he said. There was something like respect in his voice. "Once was," she agreed. "You guys have made some improvements." "Study the recon operators at the academy," the Laconian said. "You guys were the real deal. Heartbreakers and life-takers." "Less and less of both as time goes on," Bobby said, and tried out a smile. The Laconian smiled back. He was half her age, at most, but it was nice to know she could still pull him when she wanted to. She could have imagined the kid on the tube station back at home. Shit, he probably had family back on Mars. "I bet you do okay," he replied, still smiling. "You see any action?" She smiled back, and the kid realized what he'd said. A little blush touched his cheek. "Some," Bobby said. "I was on Ganymede in the lead-up to the Io campaign, and I was on Io." "No shit." "I don't suppose there's any way an old Marine could try one of those suits out, is there?" Bobby said, ratcheting the smile up a notch. "I don't use sex as a weapon," she thought to herself, "but I'd love to get my hands on your outfit." The Laconian started to reply, then got a distant look on his face that Bobby recognized. Someone on the group comm was talking in his ear. "Move along, citizen," he said to her, the smile gone. "Thanks for the time," she said, then pulled herself to the back of her line. The wait was long and uncomfortably warm. The others there with her had flight suit patches from a dozen other ships, and the same hang-dog expression. It was like they were being treated this way because they'd done something to deserve it. Bobby tried not to look like that. The dockmaster's office was small and harshly lit. She identified herself and her ship, and before she could give any context, the new dockmaster cut her off. "As a military vessel, the Ceres-registered ship called Rocinante is now impounded by the Laconian Naval Command." He was a small, dark man in a Laconian naval uniform, and the look on his face was the mix of boredom and irritation shared by all natural-born bureaucrats. A screen on the wall listed all the ships in the slow zone and their statuses.